From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from San Leandro.
I'm living in Richmond.
Vallejo.
San Jose.
Oakland.
West Oakland.
I live in the bottom.
I'm in downtown Oakland.
In the bottom of 12th Street.
Coming up, a team of urban studies students puts evictions on the map.
And you can also begin to see what neighborhoods are being hit the hardest. And we wanted to show that.
Then we've got a drop-in appointment with the executive director of the San Francisco Rent Board.
So how many people do you have coming in here on a daily basis?
Oh, about a zillion.
And an Oakland soul food restaurant that's doing something different.
Just feeling that love in a delicious and also a healthy way, because it's not just fried meats.
Delicious and healthy. Today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Protests against the tech industry's impact on housing have been growing in number and variety. They've gotten personal, too, with individual tech executives being targeted. And they've been artistic, with brass bands, acrobatics, and street art. No matter the form, the protests all raise a few key questions. At a recent Google bus protest during the morning commute on Market Street, evicted tenant Martina Ayala took the mic.
We want action. Where is the affordable housing? Where are the business owners that have been displaced? Where is the justice? Where is your Googliness? Use it.
A search for answers has led some protesters right back to Google and other tech firms. While many activists hold the industry accountable for San Francisco's rental crisis, their feelings about tech products are a different matter. In fact, powerful software is key to a partnership project between the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project and students at Stanford University. KALW's Melanie Young reports.
At Stanford University's Geospatial Center, the air is thick with googliness.
We're going to start with Google Tour Builder. It's embedded.
A group
right
of urban study students are learning to use Google's geographic information software. They plan to program an interactive map that will put a human face on eviction statistics.
And then in the next section, we're going to have a workshop just on visualization and storytelling with maps.
Landlords filed nearly 2,000 eviction notices in San Francisco last year. That's a 14-year peak. Patricia Carbajalis, the Geospatial Center's manager, is leading the workshop.
Very easy to use, powerful stories that you can create with it.
Click where someone was evicted, and their story and slideshow will pop up. Urban studies students such as Natasha Weiss go out to get the interviews that populate the map.
Can you remember the moment you were informed you were being evicted?
Weiss is talking with Rick Gerharder, who lost his apartment in San Francisco's Bernal Heights. He's originally from South Dakota and moved here in 1977 in search of a supportive community where he could come out as gay. A few years ago, his landlord decided to sell his building and wanted the tenants out.
You know, we protested. It went on for several months. Anyway, Elmer, my roommate, got diagnosed with HIV during this whole period. You know, it couldn't have helped but hasten his death, all the stress involved with that.
When the interview is done, Weiss brings it back to the lab, edits it, and uploads it to the map, which is called the Narratives of Displacement.
My name is Nancy Hernandez.
Michael Barron.
Yasmin Golan. I've lived in the Bay Area about 17 years.
It's turned into a place for the wealthy.
You got the right to evict us.
I really felt like the mission was home.
The map is the brainchild of the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project. Their first creation was a time-lapse map, which they made last year. It portrayed Ellis Act evictions as exploding dots. The more units in the building, the bigger the explosion.
We really wanted to make visible what the accumulation of evictions over time looks like.
Erin McElroy is the founder of the project.
I think it's one thing to maybe know, like, oh, a few people in this neighborhood were evicted over the last couple of months. But when you actually see that in an accumulation, so it appears really different. And you can also begin to see what neighborhoods are being hit the hardest. And we wanted to show that.
The map begins in 1997, at the start of the first dot-com boom. Initially, just a few dots pop up here and there. But soon, the dots begin to spread all across the city. And by the end of 2013, San Francisco resembles a face covered by erupting sores.
So where's the Dirty Dozen stuff?
It's on antievictionmap.squarespace.com.
At the San Francisco Tenants Union, six men and women are at their laptops combing through the city's online databases. They're working on another map that will show who the city's top 12 evictors are. They hunt down where they work and who they do business with.
So here's one way that's really interesting. I'm in the Bureau of Real Estate. You know, I found the employing broker, the license ID, up over there. And here is a list of everybody who works with Alba Barton. So do we have these names?
Once they dug up the facts, they work on design. Buildings owned by landlords who have used the Ellis Act multiple times are identified with bright orange circles. When you click on a circle, the landlord's name and corporate affiliation appear. Go deeper, and more information about the landlord pops up.
Ooh, that's pretty.
Ooh, awesome.
I know. It's interesting. I wonder if...
Back at Stanford's Geospatial Center, the urban studies students are setting up accounts on several social media sites for their map. Jordan Carroll notes the irony of their work.
The tech companies like Facebook and stuff that are displacing the people, but we're using those services to help create this map.
Carroll says he'll be thinking about the tenants' stories when he faces upcoming choices.
I mean, like, I'll be graduating in, like, just over a year and, like, looking for a place to live. And I think, like, when I do find, like, a neighborhood to live in, I'll be more conscientious of that process and, you know, try to get to know the neighborhood more and be, like, an active community member rather than, like, a passive, just, like, moving to, like, wherever is the cool place to move to and not really thinking about it.
Well, not necessarily. If we put in another sheet, right?
This map may be pretty modern, but its purpose is an old one. It helps people who feel powerless realize they're not alone and then brings them together to challenge what's happening. The Mapping Project volunteers have five new maps in the works. As evictions continue in San Francisco, they'll add more dots and stories. For Cross Currents, I'm Melanie Young.
You can find a link to the eviction map at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Most San Francisco rental properties are under voter-mandated rent control. On those units, rents can only rise a small percentage. This year, that percentage is 1%. That's 60% of the increase in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. That can be a very uncomfortable restriction for some landlords, as we reported last week.
Having a tenant move in with a lease that lasts for 6 months or a year and then goes month to month, but really it's a lifetime lease. It's extremely difficult to get a tenant to move, even no matter how badly you need the property.
A few of you called us up with responses to this story. Here's what you had to say.
I completely support all of San Francisco's rent control and efforts to stop Ellis Act evictions. The one problem I have is with the single-family home with an in-law unit that might have been bought with the idea of moving an ailing relative in. And now, if you want to do that, it seems you have to pay maybe $50,000 under the new Ellis Act restrictions. And that doesn't seem fair, and it's unfortunate for people who bought their houses with those units thinking that they would take an elderly relative in.
Next message.
I've been a landlord for 14 years and went through everything that this person described, the hostile tenant and heartache, and I just want to again say thank you so much for presenting the small landlord side. It's such an important side that most people don't see. They don't see how much money we pay in property taxes and how much it costs to maintain our properties. And so thank you again, and thank you. Bye.
End of message.
Those were listeners Diane Ross and Mina Zaminski. We always love hearing your thoughts on our stories. Leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and you may hear yourself on the air. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. With rental housing being such a contentious topic in San Francisco, we thought it could be helpful to talk with the person who might know more about rent laws than anybody else in the city.
I'm Delene Wolf. I'm the executive director of the San Francisco Rent Board.
Wolf oversees a staff of 30 people who find themselves at the center of the city's housing debate. KALW's Ben Trefney went to their offices and asked her about what she deals with on a daily basis.
Nobody who walks into this office is happy to be here. Everybody. That's why when I go out in the city and county of San Francisco, I say I cocktail. Basically, everybody who comes in is having a landlord-tenant problem of some sort, or they just need information, or they're thinking about buying a property and they want to know how onerous it's going to be to have to deal with us. But most people who come in, especially right now, since as you're quite well aware, we're having quite the affordability crisis, so a lot of people who walk in the front door are desperate. They're losing their housing or they're afraid of losing their housing, and they want help, and we can't get people replacement housing. We raise the rent, we lower the rent, we take a look if somebody's being wrongfully evicted, because in San Francisco, the only way landlords can raise the rent to market is if they have a vacant unit, so there is kind of a built-in incentive for eviction.
You're in an interesting position where you end up hearing from both sides, landlords and tenants. I think that, well, what's your perspective on rent control from that position?
My perspective, and remember, I'm not the policymaker, I'm just the bureaucrat, but I've been here a very, very long time. I always say I have no marketable skills. All I know is rent control, but I do firmly believe, and economists may differ with me, and I know my landlord community will differ with me, but I honestly believe that this law is a necessary evil in some ways. I firmly believe that the mission would not be the mission. Chinatown would not be Chinatown. My little old ladies at Stonestown wouldn't be able to afford to still be there. And if you don't care about low-income people, you should care about our number one industry, which is tourism. And people don't come to San Francisco like they would go to the San Fernando Valley. If we don't have diversity and we're not an interesting, vibrant place, plus we need someplace for service workers who, you know, are the keep the tourist industry moving. There has to be some place for them to live. Commuting from Antioch is not really viable for low-income people, although tons of them are doing it.
Do you know if there are many pushes? I'm sure that there's different lobbying groups. Are like landlord rights groups or you know, people who have great financial interest in the idea of limiting or ending rent control, have there been efforts in the city in the last 20 years to end it because people want to capitalize more on the hot market?
Nobody is going to end rent control in San Francisco. There's a 70% tenant population. Our Board of Supervisors currently is more moderate than it's been in a while. And even the moderates on the Board of Supervisors espouse that they believe in rent control. You'll never get reelected in San Francisco if you don't at least believe in a baseline or support a baseline rent control. Certain modifications, perhaps. On a statewide level, it's very interesting because the state legislature is much more conservative about rent control issues, even though there's a supposed Democratic majority. So while you can't do a lot of sweeping pro-tenant changes in Sacramento, there have been statewide initiatives on the ballot to get rid of rent control and say that local jurisdictions cannot have rent control. And somewhat surprisingly, they overwhelmingly failed. Even people in jurisdictions that don't have rent control seem to believe in local control as to that issue. And if San Francisco and Berkeley and Santa Monica think that's necessary for them, then we're not going to second guess it. Perhaps they're afraid that in their municipalities, if things got out of control, they might want the option of instituting it themselves. I don't know.
That's Delene Wolf. She's the executive director of the San Francisco Rent Board. Let's talk about a couple of scenarios then of people who might come in here. How about somebody comes in and they've lost their job, so they're having trouble meeting their rent. What can you tell them?
We can tell them if you can't pay your rent, your landlord has a right to evict you. And then we explain the process, and we tell them, we make referrals to places where they can help them answer the unlawful detainer. And we give them a reality check, because I think people have this myth that, oh, you can stay and not pay your rent for months and months in San Francisco, and that's not true. Actually, even though I know to a landlord who's not receiving any rent, it seems like it takes forever, but actually eviction cases go to the top of the court calendar. And a tenant, if a landlord does it right and gets legal assistance, a tenant who doesn't pay their rent should be out within 3 months max.
How about a tenant or a prospective tenant who is looking for an affordable apartment because they don't make a whole lot of money, and they say, where am I going to find that, Delene?
And I say, well, here's a whole bunch of waiting lists you can get on. Never is never good for you. I mean, it's terrible. It's terribly depressing.
Does that mean that there aren't really any recourses for people to find, say, if they have a family and they need a place that's not a shared apartment with, say, some other single people or something like that? I mean, where can they go to find some sort of a rent in San Francisco that's affordable?
My legal secretary commutes in from Pittsburgh every day. She got Ellis acted, and she got a buyout, a big buyout, and she bought a little house out in Pittsburgh.
How does she feel about that?
She loves having a little house. She never would have been a homeowner otherwise, and 3 hours of her day for the commute, she's pretty exhausted and grumpy all the time.
How about a landlord who has a tenant who's been in since the 70s, and they know they're getting much, much, much less than market value for that unit, and they say, what can I do about this situation, which has turned into kind of a money pit for me?
You know, we would investigate any of their options for rent increases under our law, but the fact that somebody who's lived there for that long is paying way less than market rent, that does not come as a surprise to us. Rent control protects longstanding tenants from market rents, from inflated market rents. And for that person, there's no remedy to bring the rent up to market. If there was, there would be no rent control.
So the mechanisms that they would have to then evict somebody and make a vacant property, I mean, primarily that's the Ellis Act. Is that the only mechanism where I think the definition of Ellis Act is essentially the property becomes owner-occupied?
No, it doesn't become owner-occupied necessarily. It just is no longer a residential rental unit. So if you take you would have to take all of the units in the building off the market, and you can't rent them for an additional 5 or 10 years, depending on it's complicated. But it is, what usually happens is that if you're taking the buildings off the market, some people will say they're doing it because they just don't want to be in the business anymore. But I think that's a minority, to be honest. If you look at the statistics, and people have been doing studies recently, quite a bit of the Ellis activity that's going on are speculators who are buying the properties and turning around and selling them as TICs quite, you know, within the first year, if not the first 10 minutes, basically, because then they can be sold at, you know, it's very lucrative to do that.
And how did that law change recently? Because the condo conversion in San Francisco, that had a change in the law.
There, it used to be that, you know, people could get into the condo lottery, and it was taking a tremendous amount of time. And so there was just a piece of legislation that passed because there was this pent-up demand from TIC owners who thought they were going to be able to condo convert and had been waiting 7, 8 years for some of them. So what they did is they allowed those people, I think it was about 1,500 units, to convert, but with the commensurate kibosh on any future condominium conversions for the next 10 years. So now people who are going to Ellis and have those units as to convert them into TICs, tenancies in common, will not be able to condo convert them for the next 10 years. So we thought that would drive down the demand. I didn't pass this legislation. I don't pass any legislation, obviously. But you
have to stay aware of it.
I try, but lately it's increasingly difficult, to be honest. They're keeping us quite busy. But in any event, we thought that the demand would be less because those people aren't going to be able to condo convert, but the demands of homeownership seem to have not slacked at all.
Delene Wolf is executive director of the San Francisco Rent Board. She spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can get your own questions answered by the Rent Board, find their contact information, and answers to frequently asked questions at our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and now it's time to eat. It's peak lunch hours for Tamara Dyson and her unassuming restaurant just north of Jack London Square in Oakland. Inside what happens to be the oldest building in town, you'll find one of the East Bay's most celebrated soul food eateries. Even more surprising, it's 100% vegan. You heard that right, vegan soul food. Dyson has reconciled the starchy, cholesterol-ridden delicacies of traditional Southern cuisine to create Solely Vegan, an award-winning menu sporting crowd favorites like Southern fried tofu, fried kale, and vegan mac and cheese.
So everything is not only for vegans, but for people to come here and experience and say, God, all that stuff is vegan? No milk, no eggs, you know, no butter, and it tastes that good.
Reporter Adeline Baxter has the story of the Oaklander who combined comfort food with healthy eating.
Even though Solely Vegan owner Tamara Dyson was born and raised in the Bay Area, her roots go back to Louisiana, where her grandpa was born. As a kid, she watched her mom make traditional Southern meals for him daily, meals full of rich, fatty ingredients.
The eggs, you know, the grits, the sausage, the bacon, you know, corn, full-blown country breakfast.
Tamara decided to go vegan as a teenager. As she got more interested in cooking, she started incorporating elements of the South into her food. That's when she realized that two completely different cuisines could work together.
I felt like I really had something to offer people in the way of perception of, you know, vegan food. You know, because I've eaten at places, and I'm like, oh my God, this is why people don't like vegan food. You know, the tofu, you know, maybe the consistency of the tofu or the blandness of the dish or whatever.
Tamara was interested in medicine and worked at Marin General Hospital for 10 years. Seven of those were in the endoscopy department, where she saw the effects bad diet can have on the digestive system firsthand. That affected her choices as a cook.
I pay attention to what I'm putting in everything so that everything that you're eating does something for your body.
Tamara started selling products under the name Solely Vegan at local farmers markets in 2006. She launched a catering business and realized her dream by opening the restaurant near Jack London Square in 2009.
We get people coming in like every day. I'm like, wow, like really?
That's Tamara's son, Akil Rahman.
But I think it's just because it's literally home cooking. Literally. Like it's not, it doesn't have the mass production feel.
Akil's been a part of Solely Vegan since he was an 11-year-old helping his mom out at the Grand Lake farmers market. They've come a long way.
It's pretty mind-boggling, actually, like that we're actually in this facility. Like we used to talk about when we would get our own restaurant and our own like kitchen, and like when that all became real, it was really cool.
One of the things that strikes you when you walk into Solely Vegan is the diversity of its customers, ages, ethnicities, everything.
I heard it was awesome.
Aaron Walter is a first timer and not a vegan.
I heard there was awesome vegan soul food here, and I was craving soul food today and a food adventure, so I came out here and pleasantly surprised. This is so awesome.
Zoe Bresny is a regular and mostly a vegetarian.
Comfort food meets vegan. And I like coming here after work for a beer and potato salad, black-eyed peas.
Melissa Davenport grew up in Michigan and missed Detroit's authentic soul food when she moved to the Bay Area. Then, she and her husband found Solely Vegan.
When you walk into the restaurant, it kind of takes you back to, like, this, for us, like, it was kind of like Detroit. It really was, like, going into that, you know, mom-and-pop restaurant, that nice, soulful feeling of just love and, like, culture. It's beautiful. It really is.
The walls of Tamara Dyson's restaurant are covered with pictures of her family. Classic R&B serenades customers as they dig into fried okra and fresh peach cobbler.
People set up dominoes here, and they're like cards and games, and they're chilling. Like, they love the atmosphere. They're relaxed. And I'm like, that's what I want. That's exactly what I want.
Now, Tamara is taking her business beyond the walls of the restaurant. In a way, she's actually returning it to its roots, marketing a grab-and-go line of vegan food, more like what she used to sell at farmers markets. So far, her products are in four local supermarkets, and she's talking with national chains about going there too.
I think it's important to have good food accessible, you know. And if I can be in that lineup and be a part of somebody making a healthier decision, I think it's powerful.
And it's present in an unassuming building just off Jack London Square. In Oakland, I'm Adeline Baxter for Cross Currents.
Hey, get right for soul food.
Want a taste for yourself? Find a link to the hours and location of Solely Vegan on our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. And that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes David Boyer, Laura Flynn, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Jasmine Lopez, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Our line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director.
Give me the black eyed peas.
Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported public radio.
One, two.
You're listening to the Parmesans from San Francisco. That might be a cheesy name, but their music is tasty. It's a blend of contemporary folk, alt-country, with some bluegrass for garnish. You can hear the Parmesans on Thursday night at the Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco. Music starts at 9:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.